Welcome to Intergalactic Relations, a University of Sussex podcast. On this season's podcast, we explore the liberal utopianism of Star Trek: The Next Generation. From the profound optimism of early seasons, mirroring the optimism at the end of the Cold War, to the pessimism that creeps into the show a few years later, as the inhuman results of shock therapy in the former Soviet Union and US misadventure in Somalia showed the limits of that post-Cold War order. We hope you'll learn a little about Star Trek and a little about international relations. Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Faiz Sheikh, lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. I'm a big fan of Star Trek The Next Generation, and I think that if the show had been brave enough to showcase queer characters on the main cast, Picard and Q should have been an item. With me are my co-hosts, Dr. Sarah Bulmer, a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at the University of Exeter. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Faiz.
And Dr. Dan Watson, consultant researcher on civil wars and peace building. Hi, Dan.
Resistance is futile. So what an intro, like, as a way of, so when you answer the phone, just to tell them
that. Agreed. Should start bringing that into parlance more. Great. So for this episode of the podcast, we watched season 2, episode 16, titled Q Who. In it, we meet for the third time a character called Q, who is some kind of intergalactic deity, basically, in the sense that he's omnipotent, omnipotent, he can do anything, knows everything, and he just plays with the characters of the show. He finds them curious, finds them maybe a bit repulsive, and he's just messing with them like a child messes with ants, maybe, because he's so far removed from humanity or us mortal beings. He takes umbrage with something the crew does and decides to show them that they are actually not as prepared as they think they are and should be more ready and willing to work with Q and rely on Q. And to do this, he sends them to uncharted space with the click of a finger, and they encounter the Borg. And this is the episode that introduces this race of what will become techno-zombies, but they're not quite that at the moment. But a race of beings who are, the show is trying to communicate, is so very different from us and so dangerous to us that we're simply not ready for exploration, and we should, you know, go back home and get better prepared or ask you for help, which is really all he wanted. Okay, we will discuss the episode first and then try to apply some international relations theory or analysis to any of the issues we identify. And finally, we will talk about that overarching theme about liberal utopia. So, to begin, what do we think about the episode and any issues we might have with it?
I love any kind of episode with Q. Q-pisodes, love them. He's one of my favourites because he's just such an epic troller of Starfleet, and actually just a really epic troller of sort of Starfleet masculinity. And he himself is really camp, and he's really bitchy. He's kind of inhabiting that sassy gay friend kind of vibe. And he's always doing these like theatrical flourishes and stuff with costumes and bits in Spanish for no reason. So I love him, and I love all the episodes with him in it. I think he's brilliant.
I can't disagree, Sarah. He's excellent.
It's one of my favourite episodes, actually. I really get like the sense of dread that you get in the episode. I think the pacing in it is generally very good, perhaps with the exception of the rather unfortunate character of Sonia Gomez. I think it really nails it a lot of the time.
Oh my gosh, should we begin with Sonia Gomez? I think we all had something to say about her. She starts the episode, like the pre-credit sequences with her, and then she has like a line in the middle of the episode, and then she's gone. I don't think we see her again. What?
I think she's in one other episode in season 2, but yeah, then she's gone.
What is her deal? Who wants to tell us? Tell the audience, what does she get up to in that pre-credit sequence? Why is she so weird?
She gets a hot chocolate, doesn't she? She's I think she's meant to be a bit of like kind of manic energy, comic relief, but ends up being quite a frustrating character and so eager to impress people that she ends up kind of repelling them. But yeah, she gets a hot chocolate while in engineering and then spills it on the captain when he comes in, which causes a sort of a more mortifying embarrassment for Gomez.
It's a rare entry into physical comedy for Star Trek. It's, yeah, quite strange.
I don't know. I mean, Sonya, I think, is an interesting character because she's like the super keen ensign who's come along. She's like clearly really bright and really wanted to be on the Enterprise and is trying to impress. She also introduces the whole idea of dehumanization in the episode because she, the whole thing opens when she's saying please and thank you to a replicator. Mm. And then Geordi's like, why are you doing that? And she's like, well, because with so much artificial intelligence around, we might, you know, it's a bit dehumanizing. So, you know, why not combat that with some simple courtesy? It's the kind of thing that she says. And so she's kind of introducing, I think, again, this idea that artificial intelligence or artificial life forms are not human. So that's her point. But I noticed that Geordi just totally puts her down. And I'm like, you wonder why you haven't got a girlfriend, mate. You're basically a bit of a misogynist. Because like, as soon as she explains this, he goes, oh, for someone who's just joined, you're not shy about your opinions. I was like, asshole. Like, why is he doing that?
Absolutely. And
then, yeah. But actually, on a more serious note, I think also her character is showing what's required for the institutionalization process of being in Starfleet, because they show how later on when she's upset about the crew that have died and Geordi's like, suck it up. We get trained how to like deal with this. We grieve about them later. And it's a similar thing. So she's being told and inculcated into Starfleet. You need to be obedient, not sort of dish out your opinions and, you know,
yeah.
need to learn how to be one of us.
I think for me, it's her compulsion. Like I must be the best.
And that.
This is kind of, it doesn't really resonate with how Starfleet is, like, I guess kind of subtly presented as being sort of more egalitarian. Like, if you want to be the best, like, what's going on there?
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't think it is egalitarian. I think it's like full of like alphas. It's like really like, I'm the best. I had to be the best. Wesley has to be the best. Picard was the best runner and he's like an archaeologist and he plays instrument. I mean, it's ridiculous. Who are these people? They're like the best at everything.
They are the best at everything. And Sisko, there's that episode of Deep Space Nine, which is a totally other show, where Sisko's in this long mood with a different crew of Vulcans, and they play baseball, and he has to be the best at baseball. And it is a theme, but I want to sympathetically say that they happen to be the best because when you unleash human potential in the way that only the liberal future can provide, by guarding your freedoms and doing what your heart desires, well, you'll end up being the best at all these things. You know, everyone is a flipping Renaissance man or person, you know? They have multiple interests and they're great at all of them.
Yeah, and they're always doing like PhD level science. They're always like some sort of expert in something, just these like random ensigns. It's like, what?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, back to Gomez and Geordi. I feel the hierarchy asserts itself again with Captain Picard when the hot chocolate is spilt on him. Gomez, who just did the spilling, is of course mortified. But then Geordi sort of steps in and has to quickly say, like, oh, I must take responsibility, sir. Like, they all have to bow in front of Picard for some reason. The way hierarchy is presented there, the ensign to Geordi was a higher rank than her line manager, so we say, and then Picard is the captain of the ship. Again, there's something going on there that I don't know that we see often in the show, but that also goes against maybe the egalitarian spirit of this future that we're meant to be seeing.
Also, I just want to say something about the coffee.
Yes.
When the hot chocolate gets spilt on Picard and Gomez is like embarrassingly trying to like mop it off him, which I really sympathize with because I would totally be doing that as well. And he says, oh, it'll be easy if I just go and change my uniform. And then I was wondering, how do they wash clothes? Do you think it's a sonic washing machine, like the showers? But like, then I was thinking about how little of the social reproduction of everyday life is in the show at all. Like, they never pee, ever. They don't do laundry. They don't do any of those things.
I think the captain's quarters has a bathtub, but I think that's the only time we see any bathing thing. So there is Mott the barber as well, who comes in later, yeah. Right? So that's one element, but yeah, you're right.
Hold on. Sarah's favourite episode where Troy turns into a fish. That is also a bathtub there, right? She's
I hate that episode. Yeah, there's a bathtub, but you never see it. They don't really go, oh, I'm going to have a bath, or like they just like, and they, yeah, they never have a loo break ever. Like, are there any loos on in engineering? Like, it's so weird. It's so like weirdly disembodied.
We see them exercise quite a lot in the holodeck, when they finish exercising, they just walk around like, yo, it's not a problem. But I mean, I don't know about you, but gyms aren't exactly known for smelling good, nor the people who use them. So yeah. Nice. We'll be on the lookout for washing machines, 24th century washing machines, as we continue through the series. So Q shows up. They've had a meeting with Q before. He shows up in the pilot of the show as a two-parter, encounter at Farpoint, where this intergalactic being decides to put humanity on trial, or no, put the crew of the Enterprise on trial for the crimes of humanity. Like, how dare you try and better yourselves and explore the stars? Don't you remember that you did the Inquisition and, like, you murder each other over superstition? And he puts it to Picard and the crew. They have to prove they are no longer like that anymore. And it's a real mission statement for the show and setting out who these utopian individuals are and how they're so different from us today, like contemporary humans. Like, they're not us. They're meant to be different. But he's back and he's causing mischief. And I mean, he definitely likes Picard. But is it just a curiosity, maybe?
Yeah, he definitely likes Picard, but I feel like it's just much more that he's just playing with him and just rinsing him relentlessly.
He shows up and he asks to be part of the crew. He says he's bored and he had such a good time with them last time. So
he seems to also let it slip he's been kicked out of the Q continuum as well.
That's true.
So he's sort of a rogue element within a rogue element.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one of the things I like about Q in this episode is he's a great kind of counterweight to both the Federation but also the Borg as this kind of very organized, order-focused force. And Q is just this, yeah, like an imp. This is how he describes Guinan later on, but...
Yeah, yeah, he calls Guinan an imp and Picard says, you're describing yourself, Q. Guinan's great. You're a chaotic individual.
He just brings all the fun and the level, you know, because it's all just so serious and worthy otherwise, isn't it? It's all a bit kind of boring. Whereas he's just like, whatever, like, I've killed some people, who cares? And like, he's just like, thinks it's all really funny. And I think it's a really nice relief from the like worthiness of Starfleet.
Can we clarify, Sarah, are you saying when 18 people die on the ship, you find it relief? Fine.
I don't. Q does. Q's just like, but he has a totally different perspective because he's omnipotent and he's not going to die and he sees millions and billions of races die. Like, it's like, whatever.
Yeah. Interestingly, he and Guinan have a history together. It seems that they know each other 2 centuries ago, which is the first drop to the audience that Guinan is not who she seems entirely, and they do explore that in later episodes, particularly Time's Arrow, a two-parter. He says that they're not ready. He says, you humans, the Enterprise, Starfleet, you're not ready to explore the stars. There are things out there you can't imagine, wonders, but also terrors, and you need me. So why don't you let me join the crew? And they refuse, just point blank, which makes sense. I mean, you wouldn't want him around, I don't think. Anything there for us? I want to talk about Worf. I always want to talk about Worf. But like, we know, we the audience know that he can do anything. He's not, we can't perceive who he is. He chooses to take a form, a human-like form for our sake, but he is something else. He calls himself a cosmic entity.
I thought you were talking about Worf.
No, sorry, Q. Ah. Q thinks of himself as a cosmic entity, right? We know this of Q. And the crew know this of Q. They've met him twice now, both in the pilot and in another episode earlier in this season or the previous. And yet, when he shows up, insults Worf, calls him a microbrain, Worf starts to like push past Riker as if he was going to start a fight with Q. Picard has to tell him off. Picard has to say, Worf,
restrain yourself.
Like you're telling off a small child, you know. He doesn't he just shouts his name, morphs like, he takes a step back. And then the scene continues, the camera angle changes, and for no provocation whatsoever, I think Q is just talking to Picard. Worf just starts walking up behind Q again, as if he's gonna assault him. And Picard says, Worf again, and then throws his he points at the door. He says, Worf, and points at the door, and that's it. And then Worf has to like, and he walks out. What is happening? What is Worf doing? They're portraying him as if he was truly a microbrain. I mean, Q insults everyone, and it's not accurate. It's not fair. You know, he's trolling them, as you said, Sarah. But I'm tempted to agree with him if Worf thinks he can, go toe to toe with a cosmic entity. I don't know. I find it very strange. Very strange characterization for the head of security.
Yeah, they just play him as like a bit of a meathead.
Yeah.
Who can't control his aggression because he's a warrior, and so he has to defend his honor always.
That's it. He's defending his honor. Exactly right.
Yep.
All right, that makes sense, I suppose. Honor, honor, Worf, Worf, pain, etc., etc. There's a wonderful episode where I think that he has like some kind of thing on bar mitzvah, which involves...
Yeah, with the pain sticks. The pain sticks.
To become a man, I must be hit with pain.
They're like, hit me with...
Yeah. And then we meet the Borg. You've said, Sarah, they're meant to be everything that our human characters are not.
Mm.
Which means what exactly? Like, how do they present in the show?
They're presented as, they're not individuals, they're a collective. They are not interested in morality, politics, power, conquest. They're just literally utilitarian. They want your technology. That's all they care about. You can't reason with them. You can't debate with them. They're sort of this almost extra political kind of force. They're like pure, I don't know, pure techno supremacy. There's nothing else there.
Yeah, their only regard for other cultures is what they can instrumentalize from them.
Yeah, nice.
But they also seem to have no sense of history. And that's one of the things that I think is done very effectively in the show, that we don't know where they came from. It's not obvious that you would get much of a living record of what Borg society would look like through the ages. It seems almost kind of static in a way, despite being, you know, quite dynamic in other ways in terms of absorbing other cultures.
Well, and there wouldn't be a Borg society because there's no individuals. So it doesn't even fit into our kind of understanding of what a society might even be, because it's just this one uniform. Even the cube that their like ship is, it's just like a cube, generalized design. There's no bridge. It's its own little self-contained thing, and it looks like a prison. It's just one big totality.
Yeah, same. It's the same whichever angle you look at it.
Yeah.
Hugh taunts them at various points in the show. He sort of shows up to tell them some tidbit about the Borg or about the situation. And at one point he says that they're not interested in power or politics. They're only interested in consuming. He calls them the ultimate user. So then there's many different registers in which they are different from us and the future us of the show, right? This collectivity, this extra political nature that they have.
Yeah, I think it's telegraphed in quite an effective way when the captain tries to hail them and speaks to the Borg ship, and he's just blanked. They're just not interested in speaking with him. And then he raises the shield at Guinan's urging. She says, protect yourself. These people are dangerous. And then they just beam in somebody into engineering who just goes around with no regard for there being other crew and just starts assessing their different systems. I think that's a fantastic way of showing how unfamiliar, because like, Star Trek is meant to be like looking at alien cultures, but a lot of them are actually very similar to human cultures in how they're organized, how they interact with Starfleet. This is something that's fundamentally quite different, I think. And you get that later on in the show when they transport onto the Borg ship. And again, they're just ignored by the Borg because they just don't regard them as a threat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they don't grieve their losses either. Like on the engineering, where they manage to take down one of, that doesn't Worf, he manages to kill one of the Borg, and then another one beams in because it's totally irrelevant to them. Like they don't care. They've got plenty of these drones. And then he like pulls out his like chip, or I don't know which bit it is. It's the eye chip that they pull out of their dead because it's got some information. And it's like really brutal And again, really utilitarian, really instrumental in even the way that they relate to each other.
Yeah, on this episode in engineering where the Borg, when the Borg drone appears on engineering and starts scanning the ship, 2 points, I guess, related to that. Binance says raise the shields and they do it. Whenever Worf says raise the shields, they say, no, shut up, Worf. That's not
super. No, this isn't true. Guinan is ignored several times during this episode. And there's a lot of hubris. Like when they first turn up and they're in Borg space before they meet the Borg, Guinan says, you need to turn around and go back home now. And Picard goes, no, I can't resist exploring. And I've literally written in my notes, hubris, like, here we go. And then later on, there's something else where she's warning them and they're doing it. Oh, yeah, they want to go and beam on and do an away team. She's like, no, that's not a good idea. And they do it anyway.
Yeah. So, no, you're right. Absolutely right. The next thing is that the Borg is scanning the ship and a Q taunts them like, ooh, I wouldn't let them
take control of your ship.
Take control of your ship. Bad things will happen. At which point Picard's like, Worf, do something. And you think, yes, already Worf's been held back. Picard's had to tell him, no, Worf, step back. And then he gives Worf an order to finally do something. He does nothing. He turns around to his underling and says, ensign. And then some no-name extra walks over and gets punched by the Borg. And it's like, Worf, that was your moment, man. I'm sad. I'm sad for Worf.
But then he shoots him with a phaser, doesn't he? And kills him.
He does, eventually. Yeah. That's not Worf's jam. Anyone could have done that.
Yeah.
But I think this is another point where this episode does a good job of showing but not telling. Because when another drone is beamed in the place of the dead one, they try and shoot it, Worf tries to shoot it again, and a shield just appears, and it really communicates quite effectively, they've adapted. There was something unfamiliar, now they've dealt with it, they've absorbed it into how they do things.
And this adaptation is something that I think Picard or Riker says earlier in the episode when Q is taunting them that you're not ready for the dangers in space, they say, no, in fact, it's Guinan. Guinan says, they will adapt. It's one of their great strengths. So she speaks to that as if she's not a human. So it's the first insight that we get that she's not maybe a human. But like Hugh, she's observing humanity and she comes to this assessment. Mm. They are good at adapting, so they'll be all right. And then the Borg come and they are, if the humans are meant to be good at adapting, then the Borg are another level.
S-tier
adaptations as shown by the phaser fire. So I find that interesting as well. Great. So they go on the ship against Guinan's advice and they explore, they learn about them a little bit and eventually realize that they're repairing themselves, at which point Picard's like, okay, never mind, enough here, let's run away. So at this point in the exchange, I think the Borg have already sort of carved out a section of the ship.
We have to talk about that bit. That is my favourite bit because that has the epic Riker line in it that is like brilliant. So it's the bit where the Borg ship has some sort of laser cutter and it cuts out a circle on the saucer section of the ship and you see it like being pulled out. And then what does Riker say? He says, they're carving us up like a roast. And it's so funny. It's one of my favourite Riker lines ever. And then 18 people die, which is obviously unfortunate.
Unfortunate. Yes. Unfortunate. Or as Q says, you know, what?
Get over it. It's a bit of a bloody nose. Get over it. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. If you can't take a bloody nose, go back under your bed.
Yeah, that's basically what he says. Yeah. Yeah. And then after this, there's a conference. That's what it is. Conference. We've just been carved up. We need to like discuss this.
Zoom chat.
At least twice, maybe more. Picard just shouts to the camera, conference, which indicates like, oh, we're going to change scenes to some interesting deliberations amongst these various talking heads.
So they've literally just been like almost killed, sucked in by a tractor beam. They've had a section carved out, but they've got to have time to have a conference.
I don't know if you've ever seen Line of Duty, the sort of the British kind of police procedural drama, but it starts off where they're like these police are going to like knock down a suspected terrorist door, And it's like, stop, have you done a risk assessment? it's this great example of like how managerialism kind of just creates these bizarre discrepancies. And I feel like the conference stuff is like, procedure first, guys. We must have a conference.
Part of me thinks it's almost aspirational. We're having good fun at the conference, but I think it's presented as in like, look at these cool, rational, reasonable individuals who, they're not going to take an impulsive decision, even though they're just being attacked. They're going to chat about it and come to some, you know,
deliberative democracy.
Yeah. I think that's what's being communicated, right? As opposed to the Borg, who wouldn't do this. They don't need this. They're kind of always in conference.
They can sort of do it in the background.
Because they're a collective. So they're always in conference.
Faiz, I really love it when Picard is asking, or he's saying like, Q, do something, you know, like, is this real? Is this one of your sick games? And then I think he replies by going, this is as real as your so-called life gets. It's so bitchy.
It's so good. It's your so-called life. Yeah.
I love it.
All right. So the away team, they go on board. We've talked about that. And then they leave. But then the Borg give chase as Picard tries to escape. And they are clearly... they've done their adaptation. Whatever the Enterprise did, whatever use of force that they applied the first time round, isn't working the second time round. They keep escalating, but none of it's working. The Borg have adapted. They've taken a little bit of their technology. They took a slice out of the Enterprise. They've scanned them, and they've learned everything they need to know about how to combat them. That's how the Borg work. And things are looking dicey.
On that note, I almost get the impression that what they're doing is they're intentionally absorbing damage to the Borg in order to assess how the Federation are working, which is not something you would normally see the Federation doing.
Yeah. That's interesting. Provoke them into a response and then sort of measure your capabilities based on that response. It gets so bad that they're basically ready to blow themselves up in a very...
This is why it's ridiculous. So with all the like conference and reason, when they really get scared and they're being chased and they're doing photon torpedoes and they're not working, they just carry on with the photon torpedoes. And then the next set they use is going to blow up the Enterprise. And they're about to do it.
So the Borg ship has caught up with the Enterprise to such a degree that they're so close now that Data warns, if you fire those photon torpedoes, we're so close that we'd be blown up in the explosion. And Picard's like, get it ready.
Yeah, get ready. Him and Riker are like, ready.
At which point, Q shows up and...
he shouts at him. He shouts, admit it, Picard, you're out of your league.
And he does, right? Picard ends beautifully. You want me to say I need you? I need you. And then Q's happy. He's like, great. I'm wanted, I'm needed, so I'll end this. And then he just clicks his fingers and then boom, they're magically back where they were.
Yeah, and then the episode ends with Picard and Guinan playing 3D chess, which I just can't even imagine how horrific that game must be, but they all apparently play it.
The show.
And
good way to unwind, I think.
And then Picard twigs, with the help of Guinan, that now the Borg know that they're out there. They will be coming. And then it ends with this sort of like doom. And I can't help but think they should have listened to Guinan all along, because they really got themselves in a pickle.
It's true. The show tries to justify those actions later when the Borg do finally show up in a wonderful season 3, season 4, two-parter episode, The Best of Both Worlds. They do talk about how since you met the Borg, we've had time to develop some countermeasures. So the only reason they're able to push back some small amount that they're able to do in that two-parter is because of that prep time given by the Enterprise, sort of some time to explore and whatnot. So they do try and justify it. But if they didn't signal their existence to the Borg, then they might not have even come to Earth in the first place, is what Guinan's getting at, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that I like about how that works is you don't know how many Borg cubes there are out there, because they've been spanked by one Borg cube. Is that it? Or are there loads of other ones?
All this mystery is fantastic, and part of what gives the Borg their allure.
And a bit of a spoiler, like as the Borg, particularly in like the Voyager, as there's more exposition about them, they become worse and less interesting as a, as this kind of ominous force.
Exactly. So if you are interested, just stick with the Next Generation, at least, or go through it in sequence, because if you start with some of the later shows where they've completely demystified the Borg, they have a history now, we know everything about them, and they're just far less interesting as a result, I think. Let's think about some of the issues that come up for the show and how we might analyze them using the tools that international relations gives us. I think the big one to start with, and this came up when we talked about this with my colleagues in the Department of International Relations here at the University of Sussex. I had a PGR postgraduate researcher, Armando van Rankin, Dr. Julian German, and Dr. Andreas Antoniadis. They watched this episode along with an audience and had to give their immediate reflections on how this might relate. And I'd chosen these three individuals because they have some expertise on political economy, neoliberalism, capitalism, things like this, which I thought were relevant themes for the Borg. They didn't all agree, and I don't think that we all agree here on the show. They said that maybe there was some sort of classical Marxist theory being shown on screen here. I think Armando called it accumulation by dispossession, being shown by the way the Borg operate. And I think Andreas had mentioned an interesting point about ontology, which I would like to speak to maybe later. What we know about the universe, what we know and what we don't know, and how that dealing with the unknown is part of clearly the premise of the show, but also in this particular episode, when Q first puts it to them that they can't possibly be prepared for the terrors out there. And their response is, how can we be prepared for that we don't know? That's not going to stop us going and trying, and we will trust in our predictability to deal with whatever comes. And I was thinking of the flipping US Secretary of Defense under Bush Jr.
Donald Rumsfeld.
Rumsfeld, the known knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns.
Interestingly, he was both the oldest and youngest defense secretary in American history.
I'll put you on the spot, Dan. When was he the youngest? Who did he serve under then?
It was under Nixon, I think. Then he came back under Bush.
Nice.
Sorry, Bush Jr.
So yeah, like Picard's saying, Q is saying, how do you deal with the unknown unknowns? And Picard's like, not by engaging in a global war on terror and engaging in preemptive defense. Like, it's explicitly not that. He's not saying we need preemptive defense, right? Which I think speaks to the utopianism of the show versus the reality we live in. I don't know something. I better bomb everyone. Yes. And then, yeah, Julian my colleague mentioned that what was interesting to him about this episode was that conflict was being driven not by wealth and not by power, which is not something that IR is necessarily ready to discuss or open in discussing. There's a lot of assumptions around rationality among humans and societies, and the reasons we go to war are because of power or because of wealth. But here the Borg are explicitly not this. So you find that interesting as well. So those are some points from my colleagues that maybe we can jump in on, and maybe there's something else that you'd like to discuss. What do we think?
On that last point, I find it interesting because neither are the Federation supposedly guided by money or power, yet you're seeing a clash between two on certain levels, quite similar forces.
Mm. Picard does say his first thing isn't like, how do we defeat them? How do we combat them or anything like this? His first thing is, how do we establish relations? So that, again, it's trying to signal that these people are enlightened. They're different. They don't think like we would have, which is like, ah, crap. Like, how do we fight them? He's not interested in that in the first, the first encounter.
But isn't that just how in the Cold War the West liked to portray itself? Anyway, I just think this is Cold War. I think the Borgs are like quite clearly going to be the evil empire, because even the aesthetic of it, the like grey prison cell block, and they zoom out and it's all of these people, Borg drones in these little cells, and there's no individuality. I just think it's like liberalism's other, and they're portrayed as this kind of instrumental communist block.
I suspect that was in the minds of the writers. I think that subconsciously or even consciously, the Borg are probably influenced by that kind of stereotype of the USSR. What I find more, like, as I've watched it over many years and I've come back to the Borg whenever I watch Star Trek, because I find them so interesting, is that I increasingly think, well, in certain respects, they're actually more like neoliberalism, or they exemplify a lot of those tendencies. And maybe in certain ways we can say that neoliberalism and communism have certain similarities, maybe that they're not as diametrically opposed as we first think. But I think with the Borg, the kind of compulsion to accumulate and absorb, the quite decentralized nature of how they're sort of structured and organized, and how that's kind of almost sort of idealized, how adaptive they are, which is sort of very, very prominent in neoliberal discourse, like both the individual must be adaptive, they must adapt to changing / worsening economic conditions, societies must also be nimble in how they interact with one another and global firms. But I think one of the bits that I really like, that really resonates to me, is the emphasis on punishment in this episode. So the Borg say, if you defend yourself, you will be punished. And later on, it's kind of emphasized by Q, I believe, that the strategy, the modus operandi of the Borg, is to wear people down. It's to exhaust them, to deplete their resources until you basically don't have a choice but to give up and then be absorbed in it. And this to me resonates with ideas of authoritarian neoliberalism and the way in which politics is not a consensual thing that's really resolved in democracy. It's more shifted to kind of the legal sphere or to the coercive parts of the state, where groups such as miners in the UK under Thatcher, or anyone who disobeys with the neoliberal state, is basically made an example of. And to me, I see this as being more... Okay, this authoritarianism is also present in the Soviet Union in a different way, but I found that really, really quite a powerful kind of point about the Borg.
We've got a few things in the mix then, because the Borg are maybe our authoritarian neoliberalism, and our Federation is supposedly a liberal utopia, but at the same time, the Borg might be Soviet brutalism in space, and the Federation we described in a previous episode as luxury communism. So we're describing both the Borg and the Federation as both liberals or neoliberals and communists. So are we confused, or is the show confused, or are these concepts slippery enough or accommodating enough to be able to capture all of these things? I don't know. I find that interesting.
I mean, actual existing communism versus the communism that we kind of, you know, that you might theorize based on various texts, and, you know, and the communism I was talking about in the other episode are different things. And so, and I also think it's interesting to think about neoliberalism and Soviet era communism as not these opposites, because they were both very instrumentalizing of human lives. And you know, rendering those lives disposable in certain ways.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned brutalism, because like that's an architectural style that I associate, increasingly with corporate architecture as well. It's not just something that is, you know, these kind of monolithic tower blocks and that kind of thing. But the Borg are quite a good example of brutalism, because brutalism is just showing the inside on the outside. We use it to refer to like stark or bleak architecture, but it's supposed to be the bits of a building that are usually internal and output on the outside, so you can see how the building works. And the Borg cube is quite similar to that, with all the pipes running off it that begin to repair themselves. It's a really good example of that.
At that time, this is 1988 or 89, maybe, season two, that brutalism would not be associated with corporate architecture the way you're describing, Dan, right?
That probably wasn't filtered through until a few years later.
So that would still be a heavy association with the Soviet Union, presumably, as Sarah was saying.
It's true. Though I would say there's a great book by, I think it's Alex Williams and Nick Cerniak, called Inventing the Future. One of the chapters also looks at science fiction and imaginations of the future and how science fiction became increasingly dystopic with the rise of neoliberalism in the 70s. And you start to see that with like Alien, as showing this kind of bleak corporate world. And so this might be another subconscious kind of move on the part of the writers to anticipate, which I think sci-fi is very good at doing, is anticipating the future.
Nice. When did Terminator come out?
I want to say it was the first one like mid-80s and then the second one early 90s.
I've got it, 1984. So I, in my consciousness, which must have been from magazines. Does anyone remember reading magazines? I'm pretty sure I read this in one of my many sci-fi magazines of my youth, that Star Trek in the 60s, of course, was, you know, science is the future, technology will set us free, let us explore the stars, technology is great. And then Terminator comes out and popularizes this idea that, technologies are going to kill us. The future is horrible. If we automate, then those machines will turn against us and it's the end of humanity. And the Borg maybe represent or are an attempt by writers of Star Trek in the 80s to address the change in the zeitgeist where, you know, to continually say like, oh, no, technology is great, guys. People don't buy it anymore. They've seen the Terminator.
They are obsessed with technology, the Borg, in this episode. I think there's more that drives the Borg that comes across in later incarnations, encounters with them. But yeah, you're right.
Great. Any other issues? We haven't really put to bed, you know, are the Borg communists or are they neoliberals? But I suppose we don't have to make that assessment. But it's interesting how the concepts are able to accommodate both of those interpretations. Yeah.
I just go back to that point about technology, because one of the characteristics of a dystopia is, or at least certain types of dystopia, like in the kind of Blade Runner style, is a society which has significant technological advancement, but is also having a degradation of social life as life becomes worse. And that's the paradox that is present in quite a lot of dystopias. And that's really pushed to the nth degree with the Borg, of this, what seems like a pretty bleak existence if you were a Borg drone, but in a highly technologically advanced society, if we can call it that.
So on the photons, the other thing I wanted to bring up was the fact that in this Star Trek universe, what you've got is Starfleet as, on the one hand, about exploring and having a conference and discussing everything in reason. And then on the other hand, they're armed to the teeth. And this is a massively militaristic, rank organized, hierarchical structure, which is frequently engaging in all sorts of violent action. So I wondered what we thought about that.
I think Starfleet's militarism is also linked to its frontier mentality, that it's about expanding and you need to be prepared to police this frontier that's forever unfurling.
Yeah, I mean, I like that frontier analogy and I like the expansionist logics that don't come out that explicitly, but like it's absolutely always going around talking to potential new members, isn't it? And like assessing whether they're allowed to join or not. So there is this real empire-building, expansionist undercurrent to the whole thing.
It's empire by invitation, right? They have the capability to use force, but they don't use it to conquer territory or incorporate peoples into their system. It doesn't mean they're not militaristic. It doesn't explain it away. But I think in-universe, they'd say that they only use it in defense. They're never the first ones to shoot, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that absolves them of any...
It doesn't at all, because they're just like, it's a last resort. But isn't that like the narrative many Western powers talk about the use of military power now? And we're always at war, deploying our military force.
Yeah. No, fair enough. It's, what's that phrase? When all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
So, exactly.
It's all well and good to say we're peaceful and we only use these weapons in last resort, but we do have lots of very high-tech weapons.
But that's also part of like the liberal militarism, which is war from above, from afar, outsourcing it to other people.
Yeah. All right, question for you both. We're referring to them as a Borg drone. Are they referred to as a drone in this episode, or are we bringing in our understanding of the Borg as they will become in later episodes? And certainly the film.
It's the latter.
There's a film called First Contact, which makes a radical change to the Borg.
I think Q calls him a scout.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, not a drone, he's a scout, right? But not a drone. Yeah, you're right.
So the film, based on this show, where if you're interested in seeing Patrick Stewart as an action hero, some kind of Die Hard-esque Bruce Willis figure, bald in a vest, swinging on cables with a rifle in his hand. As preposterous as that sounds from anyone who knows anything about Patrick Stewart, they tried to do that in this film. So check it out.
It works. I like it. It works. And then he has the character telling him that he's Moby Dick, doesn't he?
Yes.
Have you read the book Moby Dick? And
He's Captain Ahab.
It's brilliant.
He's, oh no, Sarah.
It's brilliant. It's another dimension of his character.
We're gonna have to.
He's he's traumatized. He's seriously traumatized.
I like that, but that was dealt in the episode Family.
Yeah, they were like, oh, he's over his trauma now. Yeah, right.
He's had a fight with his brother. They rolled in the mud.
He's so not over his trauma. He was assimilated.
Yeah, we should probably say, like, this kind of stuff about assimilation in the Borg, that happens more later on. It was kind of expanded upon, but the idea is that the Borg assimilate entire societies. They can assimilate individuals by basically injecting them in the neck and with, like, nanoprobes, and they become Borg. It's a little bit different. It shows how, like, Borg social reproduction works in this episode, because you've got little sort of IKEA drawers of baby Borgs. we don't really, that's dropped.
They got rid
later
of that
on.
Idea, yeah.
Yeah, probably, probably for the best. But this, for me, is one of the interesting things about the Borg, this kind of social reproduction by assimilation, because in my own research, I'm focus in particular on the two Sudans. One of the forms of colonialism that affected parts of, particularly what's now South Sudan, was a phenomenon where slave soldiers would be kind of captured by basically like private merchants affiliated with the Ottoman Empire, who would be, these individuals were captured, turned into slave soldiers, and then forced to continue capturing slaves. And this laid a lot of the foundations, this process for what happened, this kind of garrison, kind of state that underpinned the country. And I see something similar with the Borg in how it works, which is they expand, they gobble up people, and those people in turn perpetuate that expansion. So it's an interesting form of colonialism almost, bit of internal colonialism, bit of external colonialism that sort of rolled together in the Borg.
The introduction of assimilation is additive to what we know of the Borg, and I don't think that's controversial. It makes them more compelling, more interesting, as you're saying. And that is introduced in this Best of Both Worlds episode in season 3. But then First Contact, which I was mentioning earlier, that's where something more controversial comes in, where the idea of drones comes in, because drones, as in bees, as in a hive, as in a queen. And they introduce a Borg queen as a primary villain in that film, which I don't think is so additive, although the show ran with it and, you know, Star Trek Voyager delves into it in depth, and you can go there for more. But the notion of a queen versus all the collectivism that we've been discussing thus far, I don't know that they fit together so very well.
Yeah, and it sort of implied that, well, we looked at other societies and we found that maybe some hierarchy kind of works. But which societies did they look at? Did they look at the Federation, which is both equal but also stratified?
They pick up the queen idea, don't they, in Picard? I'm not sure you watched enough of it, guys, but in there they have a human woman who sort of almost becomes like a new Borg queen.
Yes.
In the red dress.
The scientist,
like,
the scientist character.
And she's like running with a computer boffin or whatever. She's like running through the streets of somewhere in America. And she's in her red dress, but she's like basically become Borg.
Sometimes. It makes them less alien. You know, all the things we're saying that fascinates us about the Borg is besides they're so different. But then, like, oh, it's just a hierarchy. There's a queen on top and there are these servants underneath who don't have free will by some measure or another. And Voyager dives into that more and talks about it more like slavery, perhaps. And, you know, you can free the Borg drones from their control and da-da-da-da-da. Which is cool. It leads to some interesting stories, certainly in Voyager. But I don't know how much of that is maybe relevant to or would make irrelevant some of the things we've been discussing here. Let's move on and maybe discuss the last part of the podcast, which is what we have learned about the utopia of the show. What do we think?
It's a hard one, this.
I think if the Borg are a depiction of what happens in the future, a highly technological future, where life is devalued and technology has an increasing value, in a way they represent the Federation's future in that more dystopian read of that Dan was alluding to earlier. So in that sense, I think it troubles the utopia of the show. But if you read them as an analogy for the Soviet Union, then the utopia remains intact, right?
Well, I think that because there's no history to the Borg, we don't really know their origins. And it could well be that these decisions were made in the hope of benefiting either the survival of the original Borg people, or the people who became the Borg, or in that it was in some way seen as a positive thing that just got really out of control. So yeah, like this kind of unforeseen consequence that the Federation could end up one day unintentionally slipping into.
I don't really read it like that. I read it as they are the other. And I think the Federation and its values and humanity and all that sort of comes across quite kind of well, although fallible, very fallible. All of humanity's weaknesses, limitations. So it comes across as a very much an ideal that they're struggling to maintain, but sometimes they can't, hence why they suddenly reach for the photons, because, you know, the limits of what they're trying to do. So I think it does come across as quite a coherent kind of ambition that they have. And it's quite clear who's the goodies and who the baddies are and who has the moral superiority.
I think one of the hard things here is the Federation are used to basically negotiating, reaching settlements and peace treaties with different forces, where even if a species doesn't want to integrate in the Federation, that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily be at each other's throats all the time. They can have relations with one another. But with the Borg, that's just not possible, at least how it's presented. So it's almost like a kind of hard wall that the Federation's kind of vision of utopia just smashes against.
In that sense, furthers the similarity with the Soviet Union and the idea of a free world, a zone of liberal peace, etc. in the Western Hemisphere and US hegemony runs up against this hard wall of the USSR.
So I think thinking about that distinction between the liberal utopian version of the Star Trek universe and then the fact that they're armed to the teeth and frequently engaging in military action could be thought of in terms of the end of Cold War kind of policy kind of debate about whether we were going to be realist or like liberal, like what kind of world order was going to come after the end of the Soviet Union. And you can sort of see that you've got both threads running throughout Star Trek. I mean, that's one reading of it, I think. But then the other reading would be that liberalism is inherently militaristic anyway, and that's a whole other way of thinking about what's going on in the Star Trek universe. So what kind of utopia is it? It's not one that I'd necessarily want to live in.
Wow.
Because I don't want to live in a world with that much militarism.
But is it militarism only on the frontier? And in that sense, that doesn't mean we can excuse ourselves from it, just as we can't excuse ourselves from military adventures of our own governments in far-flung places. But the utopia exists for the in-group, right?
One of the ways I think about militarism is that militarism can be internal and or external. And I think this is probably more of the external variety. And you can see that in certain quite well-armed countries that get involved in lots of wars, or conversely provide a lot of peacekeepers for what are sometimes called peace enforcement missions, so quite militarized peacekeeping missions as well. And that's which also might retain domestic production for like arms or have a kind of regional staff training college or that kind of thing, somewhere like Rwanda, for instance. And these become exporters of militarism, which ends up just reshuffling violence in a region. And I would probably put Starfleet perhaps a bit more along that side of the spectrum.
Fantastic. We will pick up the theme of the Borg and their otherness more explicitly when we watch what's it called?
I Borg.
When we watch I Borg.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. But for now, I think we can say goodbye and note to everyone that these episodes will be releasing every 2 weeks, fortnightly. So the next one will be dropping in 2 weeks' time, where we will be discussing the episode Drumhead. I kind of, after some excitement this week, we're going back to another courtroom drama, much like the first episode we discussed. So I look forward to seeing you there. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Intergalactic Relations. This podcast is made possible by the International Relations Department of the University of Sussex. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes.